It is Tuesday, November 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump says he will not pursue an investigation against his former rival, Hillary Clinton. A powerful earthquake strikes Japan.
We had quite a good shaking, and it just kept going longer than the usual earthquake. You got that swaying motion when you realize, oh, this is a serious one.
And a Harry Potter prequel film tops the weekend box office. It's all ahead. There are a number of stories concerning the incoming U.S. President, Donald Trump. I spoke with VOA's Ken Bredemeyer, beginning with the announcement that the new president will not pursue an investigation of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server.
This was a key point of the campaign. He often riled up his supporters with saying that he wanted to put Hillary Clinton in jail if he were president. And they often responded with chants of lock her up. But today, Kellyanne Conway, who's now an advisor to Trump and was his campaign manager, says that he doesn't wish to pursue these charges and says that it actually might help Hillary heal in the aftermath of her stunning upset loss.
Is it known why he had this change of heart?
It's not clear at all, but trying to show perhaps some sense of magnanimity toward his defeated opponent, Rudy Giuliani, a former New York mayor who's a key Trump advisor and maybe in his administration, says that it may actually give voters a chance to take a second look at Trump and how he might operate as president.
Well, in other news concerning the future president, Trump has pledged to kill the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal on the first day.
During the campaign, he frequently campaigned against various trade deals that were either being proposed in the case of the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership, another deal with Europe, and one that has been in effect for a couple of decades involving Mexico and Canada. He says that those trade deals hurt American workers, and he plans to try to revamp them or kill them outright. He wants trade deals with individual countries, one-on-one, rather than mass deals such as the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Pact.
Well, in other financial news, this involving Mr. Trump's personal finances and his business, he is not going to be placing his business interests in a blind trust, which usually previous presidents have done. I believe he's turning his company over to his three adult children who are very involved in the company.
That's what he plans, and that's his view of a blind trust, but it's no such thing in the normal understanding of this kind of financial mechanism whereby an independent manager takes control of the assets and just lets a wealthy person such as Trump know whether how it's doing, but not what the holdings are. And if the Trump children, Eric, Donald Jr., and Ivanka, manage it, obviously President Trump would know exactly what's in the operations that his children are handling. So it's become a point of contention, and so far Trump has shown no signs of backing down and creating a blind trust.
Well, in final Trump news, final at least for today, Mr. Trump was originally supposed to meet with the New York Times and I believe called off that meeting. And now he will be meeting with representatives from the paper later today.
Donald Trump has made part of his long campaign for the presidency with attacks on the media. It's a popular stance to take among conservatives in the U.S., and he particularly doesn't like a lot of the stories that the New York Times and some of the major media in the country have written about him. So at first he said nope, he wasn't going to do it, and now he says he will talk to them. He criticized some of the network, television network coverage of him in another meeting on Monday. And so he has a contentious relationship with the U.S. media.
That's VOA's Ken Breitemeyer. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what kind of reaction is particularly that last story about the New York Times getting on social media?
Well, the interesting thing to notice that those meetings and the meeting that was off and is now back on again with the New York Times, Donald Trump first spoke about that through Twitter, as he's done with a number of things since he was elected, calling New York Times coverage inaccurate and nasty. And so we're continuing to see him communicate after these meetings or before the meetings, even as he cancels them through social media and using that as a powerful outreach tool. Now, the other set of meetings, other than the meetings with the media that have been getting a lot of attention, are the meetings with potential cabinet picks that Donald Trump has been having at a golf course that he owns in New Jersey. And there's one person in particular, Kris Kobach. He is the Secretary of State for the state of Kansas, met with Donald Trump, and there were a bunch of pictures taken with him and Trump as he was leaving. Well, these enterprising reporters in the Topeka Capital Journal of Topeka, Kansas, zoomed into one of these photos and noticed that Kris Kobach was holding a stack of papers, and they looked and were able to read out of the stack of papers the text, and it had a plan for the Department of Homeland Security that Kobach had outlined. So that set off rumors that he was being considered for Homeland Security Secretary. A lot of people noting that maybe he should have had a briefcase or somebody carry the papers for him instead of having them exposed like that, and kind of a blunder on his part. But then there are the kind of conspiracy theorists saying maybe Trump wanted him to take those papers out there and have that photograph taken to kind of throw people off the trail of who he might actually pick for Homeland Security Secretary. So a lot of parsing of this photo on social media today. But maybe, like we said, maybe he'll get a briefcase next time, especially if he gets a cabinet post. I'm sure he'll have a staff member that can carry the papers for him.
Or at least a folder or an envelope, something like that. All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A human rights group wants more government protection for Shiites in Afghanistan. The Indian military says three of its soldiers have been killed in Kashmir. The U.S. issues an alert about possible terrorist attacks in Europe during the holiday season. And Turkey fires 15,000 more people as part of a coup attempt investigation. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA recently launched the first of four advanced weather satellites for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida. Called the Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellite, R-Series, or GEOS-R, NOAA says that the satellite will help it deliver more accurate and timely weather forecasts, watches, and warnings. The satellite will maintain a geostationary orbit nearly 36,000 kilometers above Earth's western hemisphere. According to NOAA, the GEOS-R will be able to examine the skies much faster than current technology, provide frequently updated high-resolution images of Earth's weather, oceans, and environment, and keep an eye on hurricanes and other dangerous weather. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Turkey withdraws a controversial law. A powerful earthquake struck Japan's northeast Fukushima prefecture Tuesday, not far from the devastating 2011 9.0 magnitude quake that killed more than 18,000 people and caused three reactor meltdowns at a nuclear power plant. This one measured 6.9 magnitude, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, while Japanese seismologists put it at 7.4 magnitude. Tuesday's quake epicenter was just off the coast at a shallow depth of 11 kilometers. No fatalities were reported hours after it struck, but a tsunami of 1.4 meters washed ashore at Sendai, about 70 kilometers north of Fukushima. It came less than a week after a major 7.8 magnitude quake jolted the South Island of New Zealand, killing two people. A 6.3 magnitude quake hit the North Island Tuesday. Geophysicist Rafael Abreu tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Japan quake was a different temblor than the one that struck 5 years ago.
This is a normal fault as opposed to the thrust fault that was created by the Tohoku quake of 2011. This is closer to the shore. We definitely would expect to see normal faulting occurring on this location, which is pretty much what we're seeing.
What caused the tsunami?
Any type of movement that disturbs the water column. If you do any movement on the ocean floor, whether you raise it or if it goes down, which is likely to what happened in this case, that type of disturbance is going to create a disturbance in the water column, and that is what creates the tsunami.
Are we seeing an increase in seismic activity in the region?
Even though it might seem, from a general point of view, looking at the numbers, kind of like, well, we've had more quakes, but to say that there is an actual increase in seismicity because the quakes are related to each other, that would be incorrect.
Tuesday's quake shook buildings in Tokyo, 230 kilometers to the south, where Temple University Asian Studies professor Jeff Kingston felt his bed sway.
We had quite a good shaking, and it just kept going longer than the usual earthquake. You got that swaying motion when you realize, oh, this is a serious one. We're used to getting, you know, lots of earthquakes. Japan gets more above 6 magnitude earthquakes than probably any other country in the world. But yeah, this was quite a good rattle.
Well, this was eerily close to the Fukushima quake of March 2011.
Yeah, so I think it's a reminder to people about the dangers of restarting the nuclear reactors, which is high on Prime Minister Abe's agenda. And so it seems that the new nuclear regulation authority is being somewhat lax in enforcing the guidelines. For example, it just in the past 6 months has approved the extension of operating licenses for 3 reactors that are over 40 years old. And that's supposed to be extremely, you know, only under special circumstances, but it seems to be now a normal business for the NRA. And that is troubling to a lot of people here who think that these old generation reactors, probably don't have the safety features of the new generation, and there's a lot of deterioration of parts.
I know there was a no-go zone for people returning from the Fukushima quake back in 2011. Is that still a fairly populated area that was struck today?
Around the plant, nobody is living. Those are ghost towns. Everybody evacuated. I mean, initially, you know, there was 160,000 nuclear refugees, and they have been relocated elsewhere. But, you know, the government has declared some of the towns habitable, but there's nobody there. There's no shops. It's like, you know, who wants to live in a ghost town? So essentially, no, there's not a huge population there, but there are the workers at the plant.
That is Temple University Asian Studies professor Jeff Kingston. A water cooling system at a Fukushima nuclear reactor briefly stopped Tuesday as an automatic response, but it was back up and operating later in the day. In Turkey, the government has withdrawn a proposed law that would have given amnesty to those convicted of having sex with a girl under the age of 18 if they marry the victim. The bill drew national protests and international condemnation. Doreen Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim announced the withdrawal just hours before Parliament was set to vote the legislation into law. In the face of widespread condemnation, Yildirim said the legislation would now be reconsidered.
Muhalefet partilerine kendi önerilerini geliştirilmeleri için.
He said these issues will be discussed by a parliamentary commission. He said if a proposal comes from the opposition, it will be developed. He added, if not, we will fix the issue by taking suggestions of NGOs, citizens, experts and academics. All the Turkish opposition parties oppose the measure, but with the ruling AKP party having a large majority in parliament, it would easily have passed. Monday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan intervened in the controversy, calling for a broad consensus on the legislation and saying attention should be paid to criticism. Nationwide protests against the proposed law have been held across the country. The controversy appears to cut across the country's deep political divide, especially drawing women from all segments of society. As this woman protesting in Istanbul Saturday explains, I am a mother. How am I to react? This is not normal. This is a great shame. I have a child. It's beyond me. If we as mothers in this country let this happen, we are not mothers, she said. According to officials, about 3,800 men would have benefited from the proposed amnesty. The government insists the legislation was aimed at men who married women just under the legal age of consent, arguing many families have been broken up by the rigid enforcement of existing laws. But human rights groups claim that the amnesty would legitimise the practice of child brides, which remains a persistent problem in Turkey. According to a United Nations survey last year, in 15% of marriages in Turkey, one of the partners was under the legal age of consent. And in 1% of marriages, one partner was under the age of 15. Doreen Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. In Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, filmmaker David Yates recreates the on-screen magical world we came to love in the Harry Potter franchise, but without its iconic characters. Renowned Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling wrote the screenplay, introducing the Magical Society of New York City an ocean away from Hogwarts School of Wizardry. It dominated the box office this weekend, debuting at $75 million. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
New York, 1926. A destructive force is loose on the streets of the city.
Whatever it is, it must be stopped.
Living in secrecy, the Magical Society of America is in turmoil, fearing exposure and backlash from the non-magical folk, the non-mag, as they call them.
Impound that case, Graves.
Please, you don't understand. Nothing in there is dangerous.
We'll be the judges of that.
The Magical Congress of the United States of America suspects Newt Scamander is the cause of the outbreak.
It was open?
Just a smidge.
The English magical zoologist who arrives in New York City with a case full of endangered magical creatures plans to release them in their natural habitats. J.K. Rowling says Newt Scamander was the famed author of a textbook Harry Potter used at school.
While I was writing Potter, I became quite interested in Newt Scamander. So I knew quite a lot about Newt. He's been traveling the world studying magical creatures. He calls himself a magizoologist.
First trip to America?
Yes.
Academy Award winner Eddie Redmayne interprets the eccentric Scamander, who finds himself at the epicenter of the crisis when some of his creatures escape. His animals are believed to be responsible for the death and destruction in the city.
You know which of your creatures was responsible, Mr. Scamander?
Look at the marks. No creature did this.
Scamander enlists the help of two witches and Jacob, a non-mag and aspiring baker, who crossed paths with Scamander after the two accidentally switch cases. Jacobs was full of donuts. The wizard sets out to retrieve his escaped creatures and find out who is really behind the attacks. It may come as no surprise that these culprits also afflicted the Harry Potter world decades later.
There are ways in which we connect to the Potter books that I think people will find surprising.
They think this is related to Grindelwald's attacks in Europe.
We're talking about the first time a wizard rose and threatened the world order.
Harry Potter's theme against the bigotry and the idea of racial purity is repeated in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. But while Potter fans can revel in the message and the magic of a new film, the script falls rather flat, and the cast does not quite connect and excite as Harry Potter's did. However, J.K. Rowling promises more to come in the newly developed franchise, and despite the slow start, Harry Potter fans can live on that promise. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
I want to be a wizard.
A new film probably a lot of people will want to go see. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a dangerous global trend in violence against journalists. Indeed, a growing number of journalists are being targeted by violent extremists and transnational criminal organizations, said the spokesperson for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Affairs at State, Mario Crifo. Organizations such as Daesh in Iraq and Syria, extremist militias in Libya, Al-Shabaab in Somalia and Boko Haram in Nigeria have brutally attacked journalists who threaten to bring the truth of crimes and corruption to light. The Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, estimates that as many as 40% of crimes against journalists are committed by these kinds of groups and their supporters. One of those killed was Sami Jawdet Rabah. He was abducted in October 2015 by Daesh fighters in Syria, brutalized and later killed, with a video of his killing made available for the entire world to see. He was a reporter for the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, working to document the abuses of the Syrian regime and of Daesh. In June 2016, Sagal Salad Osman was attacked and gunned down in Somalia. She was a reporter with Somali National Television and Radio Mogadishu, where she worked to give voice to Somali demands for an end to the violence there. As President Barack Obama has said, the world is a better and stronger place when individual conscience and a press that is free are allowed to function. In order to achieve that vision, the U.S. has made a major reinvestment in the Securing Access to Freedom of Expression initiative. Dubbed SAFE, the initiative provides training in digital and physical security to journalists through regional centers to help them do their jobs while avoiding targeting. In addition, each year, the Department of State conducts an annual Free the Press campaign, which highlights the stories of journalists who have been imprisoned around the world and calls on governments to release them. The U.S. will continue to work to eliminate impunity for crimes against media professionals. Not only is that the right thing to do to secure justice for journalists and their families, it is essential to achieving the goal of a press that is free to report the truth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.